Coming up is the news.
Ayatollah Khamenei describes the poisoning of schoolgirls in Iran as an unforgivable crime which deserves maximum penalty. The presidents of Iran and Russia discuss the expansion of bilateral relations in a variety of fields. And Bangladesh launches an investigation into a massive fire in a Rohingya refugee camp that has left around 12,000 people without shelter. Hello and welcome to World News, coming to you live from our international studios right here in Tehran. I'm Marzia Hashmi. Thanks so much for being with us. Now, the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has urged officials to seriously pursue the cases of schoolgirls poisoning. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei stressed that the incidents would be unforgivable crimes if they're proven to be poisoning attacks. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei was referring to the cases of schoolgirls who were poisoned in several schools over the past months. The incidents have occurred in a number of cities, mostly in the central city of Qom. An unspecified number of students have been hospitalized. Now, the leaders stress that the perpetrators must be given capital punishment if the incidents turn out to be poisoning attacks. President Ebrahim Raisi has already ordered the ministers of the Intelligence and the Interior to follow up on the case. Interior Minister Ahmed Vahidi has reported the discovery of suspicious samples at affected sites. Iran's Health Minister Yunus Panahi says the suspected attacks were aimed at disrupting the girls' education. Now, the presidents of the Islamic Republic of Iran and the Russian Federation have discussed the expansion of bilateral relations. In a phone call, Ebrahim Raisi and Vladimir Putin assessed the developments in the Tehran-Moscow ties as positive. Now, they hailed boosting bilateral cooperation across various sectors, including energy and transit. The two also discussed the implementation of joint infrastructure projects, including the International North-South Transport Corridor. Now, the project is aimed at carrying transit cargo from India, Iran, and the Persian Gulf to Europe via the Russian territory. The phone conversation is the third between the two presidents since the beginning of this year. Well, Iran has pledged to keep the flow of information on its nuclear program to the International Atomic Energy Agency, but the country says that would be within the framework of the Non-Proliferation Treaty and the Safeguards Agreement. Now, the pledge was made by the director of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran. Mohammad Islami said Tehran is committed to cooperation with the agency. He also said Iran won't give in to Washington's maximum pressure campaign and attempts to pressure the country through the UN nuclear watchdog. Islami also talked about the 2015 nuclear deal and said Iran rolled back its commitments because of the delay tactics by other parties to impede a consensus. His comments come a day after a visit by the IAEA chief to Iran. It led to an agreement under which Iran voluntarily allowed the agency to conduct more verification and monitoring activities in the country. And now to Bangladesh, where fire in a Rohingya refugee camp there has destroyed scores of facilities and some 2,000 huts. Around 12,000 people have been left without shelter. We've discussed the issue in our news review program. Let's take a listen.
A massive fire rips through a Rohingya refugee camp in Bangladesh, robbing around 12,000 people of their shelter. Flames swept through the Kutubalong camp and gutted some 2,000 huts before it was brought under control. 90 facilities, including hospitals and schools, were burnt down as a result. Bangladeshi authorities are yet to release the number of casualties. They say that an investigation is underway to determine the cause of the fire. An estimated 1 million Rohingya Muslims live in the world's largest refugee camp in Bangladesh. They escaped to Bangladesh in 2017 after a genocide by the military in their homeland, Myanmar. Sebastian Abbas is a journalist and political commentator joining us from London. And we have Ahmed Uddin, who's a human rights activist, also joining us from London. Welcome to you both. Let me first start with you, Sebastian Abbas. It's unfortunate, the plight of the Rohingya refugees overall. And of course, this incident just adds really fuel to the fire of their unknown destination. They're living as refugees in Bangladesh. Tell us a little bit more about the failure of the so-called international community when it comes to their plight, because obviously Myanmar is not going to come to their rescue. And Bangladesh has done what it can at this point.
Well, the thing is that, as you say, it's yet another example of how the international, if you like, bodies are completely useless in most regards. I mean, what three of the ones that I can think of in this instance that have supposedly been trying to take action to help the Rohingya. One is the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, which filed an international lawsuit at the International Court of Justice. And all they've really got so far out of it is a court ruling to say that the Myanmar government must take preventative action. But any real sanctions or anything like that, or any real ruling, won't take place for years. The ICC, the International Criminal Court, also has simply just started an investigation, which seems to have gone under the radar. Of course, there isn't a great deal of interest. There's not a great deal of financial gain to be had out of the Rohingyas and their plight. So it doesn't really immediately come on the agenda of the usual suspects which talk about human rights, namely America and the Western imperialists. And of course, they've seen the ethnic cleansing that went on. They've seen the genocide. Literally 6,000 or 7,000 Rohingyas were killed in the first 1 or 2 months of the year, the August to September 2017 genocide. And of course, they all know about the exclusionary nature of the citizenship laws there. They know about the Buddhist extremists, the far-right nationalists, which have been persecuting these people for decades. And of course, there's been a decades of government and official systemic discrimination, racism, etc. And these people have basically no legal documents in Myanmar. Now, statelessness is just part of their norm. Targeted violence and impunity of the security forces, you know, who can get away with anything they like, is also a norm. Now, you know, there are, so many, 1 million to 300,000, I think, in Bangladesh alone. Those who are left in Myanmar are under serious threat on a constant basis. And half of those in these camps, which are being now burned down, goodness knows what really is behind that, their children. And I think it's an absolute desperate state.
Ahmed Uddin, taking a look at the plight of these Myanmar, these Rohingyas, it would be ideal for them to go back to Myanmar and for there to not be this discrimination against them, which, based on the past, some have called genocide because of the troubles that they have experienced there from the Buddhist monks, as it were. But that seems to be a remote, if not not a possibility at all. There needs to be some kind of integration either within the society that they're in, or something needs to be resolved in order for them not to go through what has been called, obviously, the largest stateless number of people in one setting. What movements forward can be made on the plight of the Rohingyas?
It's a collective effort needs to be made, because the reality is that there's over 1.2 million Rohingya in Bangladesh alone. The Rohingya diaspora is also spread up in places like Pakistan, India, and places as far as Malaysia and Indonesia. And there is no there's no guarantee that if they did return back to Myanmar, whether they face kind of continued persecution, because the current, as Saeed mentioned earlier on, that the current population in Rakhine State, the Rohingya, are facing kind of discrimination and are fear of their life, and so many have been trying to leave the state to neighboring Bangladesh, but have failed to do so, or died en route in the sea. The problem is that those countries, especially Bangladesh, have taken on the responsibility of taking care of the Rohingya, but Bangladesh alone, who cannot kind of take this responsibility on, there needs to be an international effort to solve the issue at hand, At the moment, the United Nations has said that there is a massive shortfall when it just comes just food alone. They're saying that they've reduced 17% of the food that's going into the camps, and there's going to be a further cut in this April because there's a shortfall of over £100 million. That's just food alone, and we're not talking about the hygiene. We're not talking about shelter. We're not talking about education, any of that. Even the trauma they face, the mental health assistance that they need, none of that has been attended to the way it should be. And so there needs to be a collective effort. There needs to be collective pressure on Myanmar, first of all, Myanmar to recognize the fact that Rohingya are people of Myanmar and have been in that area of Rakhine State for many generations.
All right, we're going to leave it there. Thank you. Ahmadou Dean, human rights activist there from London. And Sid Mohsen Abbas, thank you, a pleasure, a political commentator there from London. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of the News Review. Thanks for tuning in.
At least 9 police officers are killed and 16 others wounded in a bombing attack in southwest Pakistan. The bombing targeted a truck carrying paramilitary forces in Quetta Baluchistan province. A suspected bomber rammed his explosive-laden motorbike into the vehicle. The death toll is expected to rise as the injured officers are reported to be in critical condition. Shortly after the explosion, the Taliban in Pakistan claimed responsibility for the attack. Now, the group has been blamed for a string of bombings and other terrorist attacks in Pakistan recently. Officials say such attacks have surged since August of 2021, when the Taliban took power in Afghanistan. Nasser Kazmi earlier told us about the Pakistani government's measures to prevent terrorist attacks. Let's take a listen.
This was the second attack in less than 2 weeks, as the similar explosion occurred in the neighboring city of Mostong last week, and more than five civilians were killed in the attack. This was the massive attack on the Pakistani security forces after the two attacks which took place, one in the southwestern Karachi province and then in Khyber Pakhtunkhwa provinces, respectively. The government is trying its best to cope the situation at the moment, and we have seen that the Pakistani delegation led by its ministers went to Kabul and raised this issue of terrorism with the Afghan leadership, and Pakistan asked the Afghan authorities to handle those militants which are said to be hiding inside Afghanistan, especially these Tehrik-e-Taliban militants, which are close aid to Afghan Taliban at the moment. However, we have seen that the insurgents are active in Pakistan, and they are carrying out attacks inside Pakistan in various cities. So Pakistan is trying its best, while we have seen that the security has been enhanced in all porous borders with Afghanistan, especially in Balochistan and Khyber Pakhtunkhwa provinces, respectively.
The South Korean government has agreed to compensate the victims of forced labor under the former Japanese Empire. That's an attempt to remove the issue of compensations as a major hurdle to the normalization of ties with Tokyo.
As part of the support for forced labor victims and their family members, the Foundation for Victims of Forced Mobilization by Imperial Japan will pay compensation and delayed interest to the plaintiffs of 3 Supreme Court decisions in 2018.
The foreign minister described the move as a window of opportunity and a last chance to overcome hostility with Japan. He also urged Tokyo to offer a comprehensive apology. South Korea has time and again pressed Japan to compensate the survivors and families of its occupation between 1910 and 1945. Around 800,000 South Koreans were conscripted into forced labor by Japan during that period. Meanwhile, the Japanese foreign minister has welcomed South Korea's decision. The minister reiterated, however, that Tokyo stands by a 1998 declaration on the issue.
On this occasion, the Japanese government confirms that it continues to hold the same understanding of history as previous cabinets, including on the 1998 Japan-South Korea Joint Declaration.
Hayashi also said the new plan will help restore healthy ties. South Korea's Supreme Court had earlier ordered the Japanese companies to pay the compensation for forced labor. The U-turn on the ruling has sparked a backlash from victims and South Korea's main opposition party. They accused the government of capitulating to Japan. Well, the TikTok saga goes on. Beijing says the true intention of Washington is to deny China the technology and to further assert its hegemony.
Accustomed to politicizing, supplying, and weaponizing economic and trade science and technology issues under the guise of national security, with the real purpose of depriving China of its development rights and maintaining its own hegemony.
The spokesperson made the remarks in response to TikTok being potentially a target in an upcoming U.S. bill aimed at banning some foreign technology. Mao added that the U.S. banning of TikTok violates the principles of market competition and fairness and seriously undermines the international economic and trade order. Washington is expected to introduce legislation this week aimed at banning or prohibiting foreign technology products such as TikTok. Now, the White House has already ordered American federal agencies to remove the application from devices operated by their staff within 30 days. Canada and the EU have also banned TikTok. Hundreds of Austrians take to the streets of Vienna to protest against weapons delivery to Ukraine and the American business of wars. The protesters call for Austria's neutrality, stressing that delivering weapons can never bring peace. They also slammed the European Union's policy toward the war in Ukraine. They added that Austria's membership in the bloc has forced the country to support what the Union decides. Several European countries have seen rallies against Western arms flow to Ukraine since the start of the war last year. The U.S. and Western allies have provided billions of dollars in weapons to Ukraine so far. And with that, brings us to the end of this World News edition right here. Thanks so much for staying tuned.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The Ocean of Dua.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Hello everyone, brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of the program, The Ocean of Dua. During this month of Sha'ban, the month of Almighty Allah's mercy and pleasure, we will try to offer a glance into some of the passages of the whisper prayer of Sha'baniya, or the so-called Munajat Sha'baniya. Thank you in advance for staying with us. We'll be back again after listening to some parts of it.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. إلهي لم يكن لي حول فأنتقل به عن معصيتك إلا في وقت أيقظتني لمحبتك وكما أردت أن أكون كنت فشكرتك بإدخالي في كرمك ولتطهير قلبي من أوساخ الغفلة عنك.
Dear listeners, previously we were discussing this excerpt of the whispered prayer of شعبانية. إلهي لم يكن لي حول فأنتقل به عن معصيتك إلا في وقت أيقظتني لمحبتك. My Lord, I had no strength to desist from your disobedience except when you awakened me from your love because of your love. So in this part of the whispered prayer of شعبانية, the reason the Almighty Allah never lets go of the servant is mentioned as his love. This is what we concluded about in the previous episodes. This is the same thing that Imam Hussein alayhi salam in supplication of Arafah says, what has he found who has lost you? And what has he lost who has found you? So what we concluded mainly was that the dynamic force behind every action, behind every endeavor in the life of the friends of Allah is this element. It is this love of the Almighty Allah, the Exalted. His remembrance, his obedience. It is because of this element that a servant is called a servant, to be obedient to the Almighty Allah. Now, anything beside this is seen as diversion from Allah. Hence, Imam Sajjad alayhi salam seeks Allah's forgiveness for all this and says, I pray forgiveness from you for every pleasure other than that of your remembrance, for every ease other than that of intimacy with you, and for every happiness other than that of proximity to you, and for every occupation other than obeying you.
Alhamdulillah, we have been given the blessed opportunity of witnessing another month of Sha'ban, which is the month of Allah's mercy and pleasure. Hafaftahu bir rahmati wa ridwan. Allah has covered this month with His pleasure and mercy. I thought it might be good to have a little introduction to Munajat Sha'baniyya. The late Imam Khomeini in many places on several occasions emphasized on this Munajat, and in one of his sayings he said that there are many important mystical points that one can understand from the Quran and whispered prayers of Imams. And then in particular he mentioned Munajat Sha'baniyya, and he said philosophers, mystics may be able to understand some aspects of these whispered prayers. But if someone wants to really understand, must be a person who has himself achieved a high level of closeness to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, so that he can have a taste, he can have an experience of what he says. In another place, the late Imam Khomeini said something very important. He said, this Munajat Sha'baniyya is one of the whispered prayers that if someone pays attention to it and follows it and reflects on it, he can reach somewhere. He can achieve some levels of perfection. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to forgive us in this month of forgiveness and to be pleased with us in this month of pleasure. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to bless us, our families, our community, all humanity with His pleasure, with His reward, with the coming of Imam Mahdi ajjalallahu ta'ala farajahu sharif, with forgiveness, with being able to remain always on the right path.
So this hub and love that is referred to in this part of the whispered prayer, إلا في وقت أيقظتني لمحبتك, except when you awaken me from your love, can be discussed from another aspect as well. Love is something that is never dissociated from action. And in fact, the sign of the one who has fallen in love is true action, an activity, an endeavor based on that love. However, on the other hand, love compensates the inability of a deed and mediates for the performer of that deed, as love is an effective intercessor before Allah, the Exalted. This concept that love compensates the deficiency of the deeds is referred to in a lot of traditions. For example, in the supplications, in his lofty supplication at dawn, famously known as the supplication of Abu Hamza al-Thumali, Imam Zainul Abidin alayhi salam says, "My recognition, O my master, is that which guides me to you, and my love is my intercessor to you. And I trust my evidence since you have guided me to it. And I am comfortable with my intercessor since you will accept it. In fact, the best of evidence and dalil, the best of intercessors, are recognition and love. Accordingly, one whose evidence to Allah is ma'rifah, he will never be misguided. And he whose intercessor with Allah is his hub, his mahabba, shall never fail to reach the divine presence and mercy. And Allah is not such a Lord that will chastise such a person." Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn alayhi salam says elsewhere, "O Allah, you are indeed aware that though my obedience to you has not been persistent in practice, but it has endured in love and determination." Now, these words, when we think over, are in fact subtle indications to the fact that one's obedience and ta'ah to Allah may at times fall short of the desired standard. And as a result of that, it might not be possible for the person to rely upon his obedience and action to the Almighty Allah alone. But that in which the lovers never entertain doubt is their certainty that they do love Allah, the Exalted. They are sure of their own determinations and azm on moving on the path of love and obedience. This is something that there is no doubt in. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this episode. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
شعبان بجمالك جلالك زهوبان والعالم يقلك احبك يا شعبان شعبان بجمالك جلالك زهوبان شعبان بجمالك جلالك زهوبان والعالم يقلك احبك يا شعبان والعالم يقلك احبك شعبان بجمالك يا شعبان يا شعبان يا شعبان
Economic divide
It's a major breakthrough. Russian-Iranian banks linked together to international banks. Iranian-Russian banks no longer needed to use SWIFT, the long arm of illegal U.S. sanctions cut off. Is this the end of the weaponization of the U.S. dollar? What will be the impact on the economies of Russia and Iran? Those topics and more coming up in today's edition of Economic Divide. Some of the highlights: the Russia-Iran banking system includes 700 Russian and 106 foreign banks, 13 countries, Iran's CEPAM, and Russia's SPFS financial messaging system. That's how they're connected. Then, U.S.-Western sanctions. Well, this system is an alternative to SWIFT. Sanctions, they are going to be ineffective when it comes to Russia and Iran's bilateral trade. And also a link with China and India in order to do more trade. And then we'll take a look at the trade that occurs between Iran and Russia. The volume, more than $4 billion last year. Russian investment in Iran is also at a record high. And of course, this involves trade in national currencies.
For years, Iran's various industrial and business sectors have been under U.S.-led Western sanctions. One of those sectors, which have been targeted by the West, has been Iran's banking sector. And since the beginning of the war in Ukraine, Russia has become the target of various U.S. and European sanctions. Russian banks have been hit by various restrictive measures over the past year. Now Russia and Iran have come up with a new measure to circumvent sanctions for joint business efforts. Iran and Russia have connected their interbank communication and transfer systems. The measure is aimed at helping boost trade and financial transactions. Banks in the two countries that connected their messaging networks following agreements reached over the past year. At the end of January, the creation of a direct communication channel between Russian and Iranian banks was realized through the synchronization of national financial messaging systems, which are the SPFS and SEPAM, or CEPAM. The move would allow cross-border transactions without using the Western financial messaging system, SWIFT. About 700 Russian banks and 106 non-Russian banks from 13 different countries will be connected to this system.
Time now for our online social media posts. What was clear sifting through these social media posts were, even though many realized how big a news this was, they perhaps were not aware of the enormity of what this would mean when it came to trade without using the dollar or the common payment system known as SWIFT. So here goes. First up, Iran and Russia have taken a key step toward linking their banking systems in a move that further boosts their cooperation in the face of Western sanctions. An Iranian official has said that. Our next post, Iran and Russia merged banking systems. They launched their own payment system after SWIFT ban. The new system will connect 700 Russian banks and 106 foreign banks from 13 other countries. Russia plans using it to increase trade volume with Iran to $10 billion. In 1 year. Let's hope that happens. All right, next post. For decades, America has weaponized the dollar, imposing economic sanctions on any country that doesn't toe their line. There's now a global movement to de-weaponize the dollar. This is just one of the many things that are happening, along with the Saudis' oil for any currency. All right, so there you have it, the social media posts, but let's find out what our guests think. Let me introduce them. Tim Kirby, ideological director, a Eurasia Research Fellow, and multimedia project director for Syncretic Studies joins us. Tim Kirby, welcome to Economic Divide. Taking a look at this merger, or linkage, I should say, of Iran and Russia's banking system, 700 Russian banks to 106 foreign banks from 13 other countries. It's been in the works for a while. Of course, I'm sure you know that. First, please explain why Russia and Iran felt the need to link their banking systems all together. And of course, what are the benefits behind this move from the two countries?
Well, one of the reasons is that for both Iran and Russia, there's absolutely no risk to doing this because they're the two most sanctioned countries on earth that were both turned off from the SWIFT system, right? So essentially, them starting this network provides no risk. Now, with other countries joining it, we sort of get into this sort of political gamesmanship where other countries joining something that already exists, they're probably not going to be kicked off the SWIFT system. Why? Because if the West kicks everyone off, then the system dies and it can no longer be used as a threat. Because being turned off from SWIFT was something that was very much holding Russia especially in place for many, many years. But now that Russia is off of it and has survived, much like Iran was able to do, it really opens up the door to a lot of new partnerships and communication. We can't forget that even in his most recent speech on the anniversary of the war, President Putin made it a point to point out that the Russian economy has survived the largest quantity of sanctions in human history, completely unjustified, and that de-dollarization is basically part of Russia's national policy and is one of its most important strategic goals. And this partnership with Iran is part of that de-dollarization mission.
All right, let's go along with that notion of de-dollarization. Let me introduce our next guest, Vyacheslav Mutuzov, who's a former Russian diplomat, joins us. Vyacheslav Mutuzov, welcome to Economic Divide. This de-dollarization notion is something that's one of the key pillars of the linkage between Iranian and Russian banks, which I'm sure you're well aware how this will then help not evade, but it will make useless U.S. sanctions. So Russia and Iran can conduct their financial business based on the system that they have set up through the infrastructure. How much of a benefit is that going to be for both countries without the West interference in this point?
Anyhow, all now decisions from the United States and Western Europe, they showed that fighting Russia in economical and diplomatical and political field is on the ground. So I think that banking system that existed before the military operation of Russia in Ukraine against NATO organizations, they put ahead the idea of changing free economy relations to strictly controlled by the U.S. banks or U.S. or British banks on world system, banking system. I think that Russia, after this, all those measures that undertaken by the United States Congress and the European Union too, followed by other countries, I think that they push Russia to the one choice, to find opportunity to make economical relations with the world, with friendly countries, as they say, on a different base.
Time now for the Infinite News section of the program. We pick four topics from around the world to find out what's going on in those parts of the world economically. First up, we go to Brazil. And the news we picked concerns mining. There's been a crackdown in that country. Brazil urged to widen illegal gold mining in a Brazilian town. Now, 20,000 miners were accused of causing a humanitarian crisis among an estimated 28,000 tribes of a tribe by the name of Yanomami. These are tribes that are in the Amazon. Now, the Amazon is suffering not only because of its natural vegetation, i.e. trees, but also in terms of gold mining. Next up, a claim that's a term that's been used for China, it being the factory of the world. Well, there's now a piece of news that says China is no longer viable as the world's factory. But we beg to differ. Kyocera came and said that. But BHP has taken a $1 billion hit from inflation, but is optimistic on China and also on India's growth. So if it's optimistic on China, including India, then that shows that China is still
increasing its output, so to speak. Next up, a big worry for this entity by the name of Israel. Israel is suffering economically. The reason? Protest. Protest leaders have called for the shutdown of the economy for the second consecutive week. When you watch this program, it'll be the third consecutive week. This follows strikes across all sectors in what has been called Black Monday. And finally, we take a look at China and sanctions. Well, China sanctions two very large military manufacturing companies that are also known for fighter jets, namely Lockheed Martin and Raytheon, this being over Taiwan arms sales. China said the U.S. firms were put on an unreliable entities list owing to weapon sales to Taiwan.
Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
Counter the U.S. actions, Iran and Russia, both of whom are subject to American sanctions, have strengthened their bilateral political and economic ties. Joining their banking systems makes complete sense in order to drop the dollar from their trade. First up, the infrastructure. Well, that has been completed in order to connect the what's called financial messengers between Iranian and Russian banks. All Iranian banks and all Russian banks can now have standard banking messages. In technical terms, the electronic financial messaging systems of Iran, which is called SPAM domestically, and the Bank of Russia, known as SPFS, would now be linked. Very important. That took a while for that to happen. Then, the Russian messaging system includes more than 106 banks in 13 foreign countries. This means that all Iranian banks abroad and all foreign banks connected to the Russian messaging system can exchange with Iranian banks. The Iranian banking network will also have a direct connection with 106 other foreign banks, and the system would connect about 700 Russian banks with these 106 banks in 13 foreign countries. All right. Now, both countries, well, this is very noteworthy, have been disconnected from what's called SWIFT, that's the Society for Worldwide Interbank Financial Telecommunications. Now, SWIFT, which is a payments financial system, it's been accused of being influenced by the West, and in this case, the U.S., which is no surprise, really, has been accused of that. Basically, what the U.S. has done, or has been accused of, is overlooking how countries spend their money and then use that against them, as is the case against Iran and Russia. And then finally, Advancing economic ties is central to the relationship, with bilateral trade growing at this point to $4 billion last year. That's the first time ever, and that's according to both Russian and Iranian officials. Now, the Iranian government has said that Russia has invested $2.7 billion in the country since the 13th administration, headed by President Ebrahim Raisi, came into power. And that's by far the largest investor in the sanctioned Iranian economy in the first year since 2021, the start of his presidency. All right, let's find out what our guest thinks. Tim Kirby rejoins us, ideological director at the Eurasia Research Fellow and multimedia project director for Syncretic Studies. Tim Kirby, welcome back. If Iran and Russia have linked their banking systems as they announced it, what are we looking at when it comes to the SWIFT? At this point, both are off the SWIFT system. They're now obviously connected by their own infrastructure for the financial exchanges. And this may also have China come into play. Are we looking at the U.S. being weakened in terms of the sanctions that they're imposing on these countries?
Well, yeah, China is definitely the big question because on the one hand, China really has gotten most of its wealth off of the West, sort of being the West's big factory. And, you know, losing its connection to the West would probably be very destructive for the Chinese, but also be extremely destructive for the West. But at the same time, China definitely can smell the way that the wind is blowing, especially after that Nancy Pelosi visit to Taiwan. That really sent a signal. China is feels it's under no moral obligation to maintain the dollar and could very well try to sort of hedge its bets by sort of joining maybe the Iranian-Russian system. I mean, already Russia and China have already sort of between themselves in a more less official way made it very easy to exchange money between these two countries.
All right, let's find out what Vyacheslav Mutuzov thinks, the former Russian diplomat who rejoins us here. Vyacheslav Mutuzov, welcome back to Economic Divide. When we take a look at how Russia and Iran have joined their banking systems, not too far from those two countries is China. I mean, China does quite a bit of business with Russia and also with Iran. If they are going to be connected and they are not going to use SWIFT, well, Russia and Iran are not, what are we looking at when it comes to the U.S.? Because it's sanctioned these two countries. Wouldn't that kind of be counter-effective against the U.S. sanctions that then they can proceed with their financial transactions?
I'm sure that Russia and Iran has common interests today in the world policy, in regional policy, in regional interests, Middle East and Far East. We have very good relations, they say strategical relations with the Chinese Republic, People's Republic. But I think that China has very close ties, economical ties. It is tied with American economy. And that's why we don't consider that China is ready to come to Russia with its economical and financial help on supportive forces, real support, because they automatically will be under punishment of restrictions of American government, and that influence on the development of Chinese economy, Chinese project in the world. They avoid this decision that that endanger the situation, economical or political situation inside the Chinese Republic.
SPFS is the Russian equivalent of the Society for Worldwide Interbank Financial Telecommunication, or SWIFT. Its goal is to link it with other major powers like China and India. Iran's banking system was cut off from SWIFT after the former U.S. President Donald Trump reimposed the sanctions on Iran in 2018. The connection of Iran's financial institutions and banks with Russia can allow Moscow and Tehran to further their bilateral trade ties. Bilateral trade between the two countries has grown to more than $4 billion for the first time ever. Iranian officials have said that with $2.7 billion was by far the largest investor in the sanctioned Iranian economy in the first year since the August 2021. Throughout 2022, the countries reached a number of agreements expanding cooperation, from barter supply deals for Iranian turbines, spare parts, and aircraft equipment, to contracts for the joint construction of natural gas pipelines.
به نظر میسه که ما هر چقدر بتونیم به اصطلاح مبادلاتمون رو در بحث اقتصادی و تجارت خارجی با روسا با پول خودمون باشه، یعنی با روبل و ریال باشه، قطعا کمک میکنه برای دور زدن تحریما و تو بحث رفع تحریما خیلی کمک کنه.
has also joined the Russian-led Eurasian Economic Union, which ensures the freedom of movements of goods, services, and capital between the member states. Tehran and Moscow are also pursuing to strengthen the use of their national currencies and trade. The move is aimed at eventually weakening the hegemony of the U.S. dollar and the euro on their economies. In 2021, the share of settlements in national currencies exceeded 60%, and the positive trend continued last year.
Using a financial system to stop the long arms of the U.S. and Western-led sanctions has been in the works for some time. In this quick take section, our aim is to look at what has been done so far. First, a look at what's called Russia's credit card, the Mir card, an alternative to international financial services like Visa and MasterCard. The Mir is a Russian card payment system for electronic fund transfers established by the Central Bank of Russia. More than 161 million were issued by the end of September, 161 accepted throughout the Russian Federation as well as in a number of neighboring and other foreign countries, such as Iran. After Iran and Russia announced the linkage of their banking systems, Iran will be allowed to use the Mir card system since the infrastructure is now complete. The main candidates for these money transfer partnerships are countries that Iran has a free trade agreement with, including Belarus, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, and Armenia, all of which are members of the Eurasian Economic Union. We covered the linkage of Russia and Iran financial system in this program, which involved the union of Iran's SEPAM, Russia's SPFS, but Russia and China are also working on homegrown alternatives to the SWIFT payment system, China's cross-border interbank payment system, or CIPS, which processes payments in Chinese yuan, also has potential to replace SWIFT. The system has an expansive network of over 1,200 financial institutions. But what are China's intentions behind CIPS? China does have ambitions to make the yuan the most dominant reserve currency in the world, and this was most evident when it visited Saudi Arabia and asked GCC countries of the Persian Gulf, including Saudi Arabia, to settle oil and gas sales and their trade in the yuan. The key is getting these systems to all be synced in order to have a single platform to operate between countries that are aligned with each other. And let's not forget, that also includes the financial institutions, so there is still a bit of challenge there.
The Russia-Iran Banking Union is a major breakthrough in breaking the U.S. siege on countries that want to expand their economies, countries independent of U.S. foreign policy. The world has realized that, which is why financial payment systems are devised for use between these countries. The key is integrating these countries into using a system for all, minus the West and the U.S. in particular, who have played a destructive role in trying to stop economies like Russia, Iran, and even China from expanding through the use of sanctions and dollar weaponization. That does it for this edition of the program. Great to have you with us, as usual. From Mikhail Tavlyi and the entire team, it's goodbye until the next Economic Divide.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa. and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.